Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Supersized Class Action Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On March 29, 2011, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Walmart v. Dukes. The central issue in this case is whether hundreds of thousands of current and former female Walmart employees may assert claims of unlawful pay and promotion discrimination against Walmart in the form of a single nationwide class action lawsuit. To discuss the case, we have Brian T. Fitzpatrick, who is an associate professor of law at Vanderbilt University Law School. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Fitzpatrick.
The Supreme Court heard oral arguments in the Walmart v. Dukes case. The Dukes case is thought to be the largest employment discrimination class action lawsuit ever filed. The class of plaintiffs includes over 1 million current and former female employees of Walmart. They are alleging that Walmart discriminated against them on the basis of sex in violation of federal law in making promotion and pay decisions at thousands of stores over a number of years all across America. The class is seeking declaratory and injunctive relief, as well as back pay for class members and punitive damages. The average back pay award the class is seeking has been estimated at around $1,000 per plaintiff. Thus, with over 1 million plaintiffs in the case, the potential damages in this class action are well over $1 billion. The question before the Supreme Court is a preliminary one, whether this case should have been certified as a class action at all. The United States District Court for the Northern District of California certified the case as a class action under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 23B2, which is the provision used for injunctive and declaratory class actions. A sharply divided en banc panel of the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit affirmed. Walmart appealed the class certification decision to the Supreme Court, and when the court granted certiorari last year, most observers believed the court would reverse the Ninth Circuit and decertify the class. Tuesday's oral argument was consistent with these predictions. There are two questions in particular before the Supreme Court. The first question is whether this class meets the four prerequisites set forth in Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 23A, for certifying a class action: numerosity, commonality, typicality, and representativeness. The second question is whether, if the class does satisfy the prerequisites, it should be treated as a Rule 23B2 class, that is, a mandatory non-opt-out class seeking injunctive and declaratory relief, or as a Rule 23B3 class, that is, an opt-out class seeking money damages. Because the class in this case is seeking both injunctive and declaratory relief, as well as money damages, it is unclear which of the Rule 23B categories is applicable. With respect to the first question, Walmart has argued that the class should not have been certified, principally because the class fails the commonality requirement, the requirement that all members of the class share an issue of law or fact in common. Although employment class actions are frequently certified these days, according to an empirical study of all federal class action settlements over a two-year period that I published last year, labor and employment class actions now comprise 14% of the class action docket, second only to securities class actions. The plaintiff's theory of liability in this case is unusual. It is based almost entirely on broad statistical analyses showing that female employees at Walmart earned less and occupied managerial positions less frequently than their male counterparts. Because Walmart has a corporate policy that prohibits sex discrimination, the plaintiffs have argued that the reason these disparities in pay and promotion exist is because Walmart delegated discretion to local managers to make personnel decisions as they saw fit. But if this is true, then it is hard to see what the women have in common. They worked at different stores, in different places, at different times, subject to different managers. Under the plaintiff's theory of the case, The only thing these women have in common is that they worked under Walmart's policy not to have a policy. But a policy not to have a policy is not much of a common question, and it appeared from the argument that a majority of the court thought so as well. Justices Kennedy and Scalia both suggested that they thought that the plaintiff's theory of the case was inconsistent with the requirements of class certification. Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito went even further and wondered whether, if this class could be certified, a class could be certified against any employer. There has been, after all, a persistent pay gap between men and women in the American economy for as long as anyone can remember. Counsel for the class probably did the class no favors by responding that it very well may be the case that every employer in America could be sued on the class's theory. Although most of the argument focused on the question of commonality, the second question in the case, whether to treat hybrid class actions that seek both injunctive relief and money damages as injunctive class actions or damages class actions, is probably more important to the future of class action litigation in this country because that question arises so frequently. It is much easier to certify an injunctive class action under Rule 23b-2 than it is to certify a damages class action under Rule 23b-3 because the class does not need to show that the common issues predominate over the individual's issues in the class. For this reason, it is a common tactic in labor and employment and other class actions to add claims for declaratory and injunctive relief to claims for money damages in the hope that the court will use 23b-2 rather than 23b-3. For many years, lower courts have struggled on how to treat these hybrid class actions, especially when, as with the back pay in this case, the monetary relief sought by the class can be classified as equitable. As I noted, the court spent less time during the argument on this question, and it is difficult to gauge how they might answer it. It should be noted that even some of the liberal justices expressed concern about certifying mixed class actions under Rule 23b-2. It is possible that the court may not even answer the question if it decides, which, as I noted, appears likely, that the class fails the prerequisites of Rule 23a. That would be unfortunate because lower courts are in need of guidance on this question of what to do with hybrid class actions. It should also be noted that if this class does go forward, there are a number of practical issues that will arise about how to proceed where there are so many people in the class and so many different circumstances underlying their employment history. Even some of the liberal justices expressed concern about some of the ideas floated by the lower courts to manage the case should it go forward, such as the use of mathematical models rather than actual testimony to decide who in the class was discriminated against and who was not. In the middle of the exchange on this point, Justice Scalia expressed disbelief at these ideas, stating that, quote, "we must have a pretty bad judicial system," end quote, if mathematical models are more reliable than live testimony. From all indications, it appears that the class in Walmart v. Dukes may have been a bit too inventive for a few too many members of the Supreme Court. The court will issue its decision by June, and I expect it to reverse the Ninth Circuit on one or both of the questions presented.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.